the president pledges help for the panhandle.
President Trump's campaign-style stop in Florida comes with controversy.
Plus, the security of your ballot, the Russian attack on Florida's voting systems.
This is the Florida Roundup from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Well, it's been more than 6 months since Hurricane Michael devastated parts of the panhandle, but still no comprehensive aid package. This week, the president came to Florida to announce hundreds of millions in housing help. What's the holdup for more money? Will it hurt him in 2020? Plus, how close did the Russians get to hacking a Florida county's voting system?
You can join the conversation statewide at 305-995-1800 and on social media at Florida Roundup. It's all ahead with your phone calls and tweets after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, President Trump visited the panhandle this week. And at first, Tom, he didn't commit to announcing any federal aid money for hurricane victims there. Parts of the panhandle, of course, were devastated by Hurricane Michael, and money, it's been slow to arrive to the panhandle more than 6 months after the storm.
Yeah, a big federal aid package for the panhandle has been tied up in Washington over debates surrounding more federal help for another area devastated by a different hurricane, Puerto Rico. But by the time the president came to the podium in Panama City on Wednesday this week, he was ready to talk money.
Tonight, I'm pleased to announce that my administration will be allocating $448 million in HUD disaster recovery funds for the great people of Florida.
Now, the president had plenty else to say at the rally, some of it untrue, some of it incendiary. He lied to supporters there when he said Puerto Rico has already been given $91 billion in disaster aid. That's false. They haven't gotten that much. It was also deceptive of the president to say that Florida is not receiving disaster aid money because Democrats want to give Puerto Rico even more. And Trump drew heavy criticism for laughing when one member of the audience said he thought migrants at the southern border should be shot.
But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no... That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement.
That was on Wednesday in Panama City. The trip included a tour of hurricane damage in an area that will be important to President Trump and Republicans in 2020. The president won at least 70% of the vote in 2016 in the Panhandle counties hit hardest by Hurricane Michael. And he had plenty of support amongst the crowd Wednesday night.
I definitely agree with the border. Build the wall.
I feel like our unemployment rate being so low.
My 401k has gone through the roof.
He's right to life.
He's pro-life, and he supports God and Jesus and our Christian values.
So what do you think about the president's rally in Florida this week? What's the delay in getting federal aid? Should the panhandle expect more? What have you experienced visiting or living in the area hit by Hurricane Michael? The phones are open statewide now for your thoughts, your experiences. 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800 or on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
Now, Jessica Foster, anchor and reporter at WJHG News in Panama City, has been covering the impact of Hurricane Michael since it happened, also covering the president's appearance in the panhandle. She joins us now. Jessica Foster, thanks for being with us. And as we just heard, many people there at the rally were excited to see the president. That said, to date, Congress hasn't sent one dime to Florida more than 200 days after Hurricane Michael devastated the panhandle. What's the situation on the ground right now today in the panhandle? And how worried, how concerned are officials there and people about the slow pace of relief money, you know, trickling into that part of the state?
Yes, thank you for having me. I was actually on the ground at Tyndall Air Force Base when the president landed in Air Force One. And what the local leaders were hoping to hear was something, some glimmer of hope that we're going to get some type of funding. And the governor, he had asked for an increase in cost share for the 90-10 for the federal reimbursement. And that was one of the first things that the president said when he met with our local leaders at Tyndall Air Force Base, that he was going to approve that. And so the local leaders were very excited about that portion. But they know we still have to have a supplemental disaster funding bill passed in Congress. And that is what has us concerned and worried. The 90-10 cost share means that the cities and counties are not going to have to spend out as much as they thought they would. But we also need more for the infrastructure that was damaged. And that supplemental disaster funding would help a lot.
Yeah, Jessica, the 90-10 funding split, that is usually related to debris cleanup, where 10% would be the responsibility of local or state governments, 90% covered by FEMA. But it isn't money up front. These communities have to spend the money first, then they get reimbursed. Where is that money needed most? Where would this HUD money, for instance, that the president did bring along with him to Panama City this week, where is that money likely to be used?
So what we need more than anything is affordable housing, because we just don't have that right now. Businesses are trying to hire people, and they can't even hire people because they have nowhere to live. Because most of our housing inventory, especially in the Panama City area, has been depleted. And so then that forces everyone into the Panama City Beach area. Well, that is a tourist area. That area wasn't damaged like Panama City was. But you're in the tourist season right now, and we need that money, too, to survive. So it's just problem on top of problem.
And when you say people don't have places to live, how many people in that area are still living in tents or in trailers or whatever, you know, whatever makeshift housing they can figure out for themselves?
You know, it's actually hard for us to estimate that. We know that it's pretty astronomical how many people have either had to relocate or they're living with another family member or a friend. We talked with a lady. She had a home that did have some damage, but it was still livable. And she has a makeshift tent city in her backyard because people didn't have anywhere to go.
Yes.
And that's just kind of what we're seeing on the ground.
Were residents satisfied with what the president brought along with him this week to Panama City?
For the most part, they did seem fairly optimistic about what he was saying. One of the main concerns is Tyndall Air Force Base, mm-hmm. because, you know, Tyndall Air Force Base right next to Mexico Beach, which was ground zero, and it was pretty much destroyed. We're talking $4.7 billion worth of damage at Tyndall Air Force Base. Tyndall Air Force Base is about a third of our economy. And so if Tyndall Air Force Base does not come back to the strength that it once was, then that's really going to hurt the surrounding areas around it. And so one of the things that the president said was Tyndall Air Force Base is going to come back. It's going to come back better than ever. But we also know that because we didn't have any supplemental disaster funding, that all new construction at Tyndall had to be stopped at the beginning of this month. So we can say that Tyndall is going to come back, but we're going to have to see some money and some action behind that.
Certainly need that. The Panhandle needs those relief funds. And so, Jessica Foster with WJHG News in Panama City, we so appreciate you bringing us all these insights from the Panhandle here to the Florida Roundup. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
And it's 305-995-1800 to join us here on the Florida Roundup. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup as we continue talking about the president's visit to the Panhandle with Greg Allen, correspondent for NPR, and Eric Sarkissian. He's a reporter for Politico Florida. Greg Allen, let's start with you. The president dropped a couple of falsehoods, lies, at the rally the other night in the Panhandle, particularly when he was talking about disaster aid for Florida. He lied to the crowd when he said that the Puerto Rican government had received some $90 million. They have actually been allocated, or billion rather, they've actually been allocated just over $11 billion from FEMA and received about $6 billion of that. He's been criticized for, in effect, pitting one group of disaster survivors, American citizens in Puerto Rico, against another, those here in in Florida. What about that aspect of the president's comments when it comes to how this government is allocating disaster relief funds?
Well, you know, the president, as you know, tends to make things personal. And for him, I think a lot of the debate about aid to Puerto Rico has become very personal to him. He has felt insulted by the mayor of San Juan, and he has a vendetta with her. That's part of this, I think. Part of it is that Puerto Rico has had some difficulty showing how they're spending the money. The money has gone very slowly to them. We've heard the same kind of thing, though, from other places that received aid after disasters. It's very difficult now to dot all the I's and cross all the T's to show the federal government how you're spending your money. And in Puerto Rico, a place that did not quite have the same kind of systems that we have in Florida, for example, it was even more difficult. So aid's gone slowly, and so people are very unhappy there. And as a result, some people have lashed out at the president. He's lashed back. And I think that's what's led to this impasse as much as anything. In terms of the money to Puerto Rico, it's hard to depends on who you talk to about how much money has gone there. I know PolitiFact did their checking, and I think FEMA had said that they'd had sent $40 million. El Nuevo Dia, the daily in San Juan, had put the number a little bit higher at $45 billion, I guess I should say. So we'll see how this works out. But right now, it's the impasse is going on. There's some discussion being held in Congress between senators to see about some way of finding aid that can go to the Panhandle and go to the wildfires in California, mm-hmm. other disasters, and also to Puerto Rico.
We've got a call on that about kind of what the politics are in Congress regarding the funding. But Eric, let me ask you about how the president framed it in Panama City, which felt like a zero-sum game, that Puerto Rico has absorbed some of the disaster relief money that could have gone to the Panhandle. Is that the reality of it, though?
I don't think that's the reality at all. And actually, I know that there's a lot of people who are saying that the Panhandle hasn't received any federal money yet. I just checked this morning. There's a rapid feed you can get from FEMA that shows you how much money's been obligated. At least the cities and communities that were affected by Michael had received $151 million as of this morning. So there is money that's moving forward. And actually, with the president's announcement of increasing the cost share from 75% to 90%, mm-hmm. he actually jumped over a policy that they would have to hit a certain threshold based on population, which the Panhandle would never hit because it's not as populated as, say, Miami.
Right.
But he was able to use executive order to tap into funds that FEMA already has on hand. It's a different fund that FEMA had. It's in the current year budget that they. So all of the money that they're getting right now is coming from that fund. So a lot of that argument of whether or not Puerto Rico is standing in the way of the Panhandle getting funding. It's not complete. It's not 100%, you know, true. So I guess in terms of the president blaming the Democrats on that and why the Panhandle hasn't gotten money, there's some question there.
All right, let's go to your calls on this here on the Florida Roundup. Call us from wherever you are in Florida. Join the show at 305-995-1800. We'll get to your tweets in just a moment. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Vincent is in Coral Gables. Hey, Vincent, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, I was talking about the. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. It's a little hard to hear you, Vincent, but go ahead.
Oh, all right. Let me just put you out of the speaker. Sorry about
there you go. That's good.
All right, one moment. One second.
And what's your question, Vincent? What's your comment? Yeah.
Yeah, what I was saying is that the funds are there, even for Florida, Puerto Rico, but the Democrats are just trying to obstruct and not help Trump. You know, any possible way, they are just trying to make Trump look bad, all the Democrats. And that's what basically they're trying to do. And, you know, like Trump said in his rally,
and,
you know.
And you think that the reason that the Panhandle hasn't gotten the relief funds is due to obstruction by the Democrats?
Yeah, most likely, because Democrats, you know, they've been obstructing the Trump for years with this Russian hoax, you know, and
well, you know what? We're going to get to Russian hacking of election systems in Florida, actually, later in the hour, Vincent. So I thank you for your call on that. And Greg Allen of NPR, certainly supporters of the president perceive the partisan fight over disaster relief funds this way. Let's be clear on the facts, though. The president said Democrats don't want money to go to the Florida panhandle for Hurricane Michael aid. He omitted in those comments, though, that the Democrats in the Senate did vote in favor of money both for Florida and other areas hit by disasters. The fight split came down to Democrats pushing for more money for Puerto Rico. Can you explain a little bit why this partisanship bogged down the impetus to get disaster relief money to these different areas?
Yeah, Melissa, I think that Democrats aren't blameless here. If you want to start assigning blame, there are politics, there are partisan politics are playing a role here. As I recall, as the way this worked out, the first package, raid package, came out, I think it was in February, and that one had some money for Puerto Rico that the president balked at. And I believe at that time it was just the food aid money, $600 million or so, and that stopped things for a while. And that's what kind of stopped things in the Senate. The House had passed it. The Senate then didn't pass it. Then it languished. They went back. They negotiated with the White House. As the pressure rose, the president agreed to $600 million in food aid for the SNAP program, for the food stamp program for Puerto Rico. At that point, I think when Democrats saw that the president was being forced to negotiate, they decided to push for more, because certainly Puerto Rico needs more aid. And if you're doing these supplemental bills, they don't come along all the time, as we've seen here. It's been 200 some days since Michael, they haven't passed one. So when a bill comes along, you want to get in there all the people who need help. So the people in California, the people in the Midwest, the flooding, you know, those things all get loaded into this. And they wanted to put more money in for Puerto Rico. And I think part of that was seeing that there was room to negotiate with the president. And that's when he pushed back, and that's where we've got this impasse. So they did raise the ante a little bit.
Eric, how does the relationship between Governor DeSantis and President Trump play out in this?
Actually, it bodes quite well for the state itself. The story that we had published yesterday evening on Politico's main page, and also Politico Florida, was Governor DeSantis and Representative Matt Gaetz had actually went to the White House and actually had a meeting on Monday with the president about trying to get this funding, the funding increase from 75% to 90%. And at the first, the president's top advisors were against it because they didn't want to set a new precedent in future storms that more communities were going to be asking for it. It's something that they were trying to get away from, that they had grown a trend of after the 2004-2005 storm seasons. But Governor DeSantis was able to get in there. He had, you know, he definitely has the ear of the president. And more so, of course, with 2020 coming, Florida is obviously a big state for the president to win again. And obviously the panhandle is one of his greatest supporters. So it's kind of a perfect storm, so to speak. No pun intended.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I guess the other follow up there is, what about the role of the Florida delegation in Washington to this? I mean, the panhandle and Representative Gaetz is a fixture, certainly on some media, Fox News included, and he certainly has the ear of the president. But what about the delegation in Florida? 29 members. I mean, there's a significant allocation of congressional votes in the House of Representatives that certainly could apply pressure, Greg.
Well, I talked to Congressman Neil Dunn, who represents that area up there, and I think people in the House have kind of thrown up their hands about the aid package. They were able to come to pass something, and it got hung up in the Senate, and so it's really now it's up to the Senate. And so, you know, Congressman Dunn was saying, I've shed blood on this, and I'm just waiting now like everyone else. You know, former Governor Scott, now Senator Scott, is active. The people who are most active on this issue have been the senators in Puerto Rico, in Georgia, especially Senator Perdue, who's been pushing it to get aid for their farmers there. And he's also very close to the president. And they believe, what I understand is, there is some movement here, and there's some belief that we could get something, you know, soon. But you would think the president goes to the panhandle, which would be a great time to announce a deal, and it didn't happen then.
But we'll continue talking about this here on the Florida Roundup this Friday. Disaster money for the panhandle, and later in the hour, which Florida county was allegedly hacked by Russian intelligence during the election, and is our vote secure? We'll talk about that later, along with your calls. Get on the line now and join us from wherever you are in the Sunshine State here on the Florida Roundup this Friday at 305-995-1800. We'll get to your tweets after the break, too. Tweet the show right now at Florida Roundup as we continue the conversation about weather relief the security of your vote, and more. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about President Trump's visit to the Panhandle, discussing some aid for Hurricane Michael more than 200 days after that Category 5 hurricane devastated parts of the Panhandle. Greg Allen is the NPR correspondent for the southeastern United States and the Caribbean with us here in Miami. Eric Sarkisian is a reporter with Politico Florida. He is with us from our sister station, WFSU, in Tallahassee. Let's take a call from the Big Bend area, Apalachicola. Charles on line one. Go ahead, Charles. You're on the radio.
How y'all doing today?
Hey, doing good. Go ahead.
So, yeah, I was just listening in earlier on what y'all were saying about the president and whatnot. And honestly, Panhandle does really need these funds. I mean, you know, you have a lot of small rural towns such as Apalachicola in the Panhandle, and I mean, weather occurrences like this happen way too frequently on a very regular basis, and they are quite frankly very, very devastating to these local small economies.
Yeah, what do you experience in Apalachicola?
I mean, you know, a lot of obviously inclement weather, just trees down. I mean, the basics, nothing compared to Mexico Beach.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I have a lot of friends in Mexico Beach and property in Mexico Beach. And, I mean, still, you know, 6 to 8 months after this is happening, there's still, I mean, it's completely wrecked down there. I mean, it's, you drive through it, and it's almost like it's kind of like a joke because everything is still level months after this occurred. And, you know, I mean, and once again, these are small local economies that don't have the backing to just fix these things on their own. I mean, hence there being federal backing.
Yeah. Charles,
yeah.
Thanks so much. Greg Allen, you spoke to some of those municipal leaders that were directly affected. You're talking about Mexico Beach, which caught the eye of this storm, a township, a city, a village almost, with a $3 million annual budget, spending, what, 10, 20 times that on cleanup now?
Right, on just cleaning up. And, you know, the problem with that town is 80% of the houses are unlivable or gone. So people can't, there's no place to live, to come back to work. I mean, it's what's one of our, what someone was saying earlier about the affordable housing need. That's the problem. Workers don't have any place to stay. And, you know, it's not just Mexico Beach and Apalachicola, the ones on the coast. The ones inland got really hammered. Mm-hmm. Mariana, Bluntstown, the little municipalities that have these amazing debris pickup bills and then have all their buildings damaged. And they're going to need federal help to repair their town halls, their police stations, those kind of things. And that's why they're waiting for that. So
sure.
It's true that the need is great.
Yeah. These small town budgets, they simply aren't equipped to deal with this. Hence the need for that, as the caller said, is the need for that federal help. Lots of calls coming into the show about this. Let's go to Robert in Tallahassee. Hey, Robert. Thanks for your call.
Hey,
what are your
you?
Thoughts? Go ahead.
Well, I would absolutely agree with every word that last caller said. You know, people forget that we've had 3 hurricanes in a row, 3 years in a row, that has affected the Panhandle. We're still waiting for FEMA money for over 3 years for areas like Alligator Point, St. Teresa, Apalachicola. So this is money that we still haven't received. You know, I know specifically in some areas, especially the Alligator Point region, we have a road that has to be repaired on a daily basis in order for us to get on and off the point. We have no fire department. We have no emergency services there. We used to have a helipad. That's non-functioning anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also taxpayers, you know, and we account for 20% or so of the tax base of Franklin County. But yet, we have no services whatsoever, and this is just not this year. This is the last 3 years in a row.
That's right.
That
and
we have a temporary road.
And Robert, I thank you so much for reminding us all about that. Thanks for that call. That's Robert in Tallahassee. Eric Sarkisian with Politico Florida. As Robert just pointed out, we've had Hurricane Matthew, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Michael, 3 hurricanes in a row, simply battering this state. We are expected here in Florida to continue to see more frequent and more severe storms as the ocean warms. You know, These communities are just hurting so badly. And hurricane season, by the way, is starting in a few weeks. Not good news for these communities that are still awaiting that FEMA money. State disaster funds have been allocated to the Panhandle. Let's talk about that a little bit as well, if you could share some of that with us. And you know, and just bring us up to date on, you know, when do you think we're going to see some more money trickle in? I mean, this is, it's really just incredibly painful to hear these calls coming in.
Sure. To give you an example of things have changed since Governor DeSantis took office in January. If you look at Hurricane Irma, for instance, which hit almost the entire state except for, you know, the tail end of the Panhandle, in the first 6 months after the storm, the first thing that FEMA will always approve is called Category A, or debris removal, because you need to get the debris out of the way in order to start, you know, getting communities back up and running. In the first 6 months after Irma, the state had actually distributed $16,000 in the first 6 months. Compare that to Hurricane Michael. In the first 6 months after Hurricane Michael, the state actually had brought out, I think it was like something like 20 or 30 million, maybe a little bit more. The change here is a change in policy. Somehow, in the middle of Hurricane Matthew, the State Division of Emergency Management decided to go with this intense auditing system that slowed everything down. So any request for funding that is from a local government to FEMA has to go through the state. The state would audit these requests, each and every one. There's 10,000 of them. Before it gets up to FEMA, FEMA does its own intense audit, and then it comes back down, and they would do a second audit. This was tying up this money. There was a point when the state was sitting on like $50 million. From FEMA, but they wouldn't release it because they wanted to audit it. When Governor DeSantis came in, actually in Panama City, he actually announced that auditing system would be relaxed, and that he was also allowing what's called expedited funding, which allows some requests, they'll fund about half of it ahead of time due to the need, especially with some communities that are, you know, especially with what happened with Michael, which is some of the poorest areas of the state. So that the money is starting to move faster, but there is a backlog. And so DEM is they're trying to close out, they call them closing out, but they're trying to finish up Hermine. They're trying to finish up Matthew. They're trying to finish up Irma. But it's a process where they're kind of digging out of a backlog of reviews that they have to conduct. The reviews are important, though, because if you remember after the 2004-2005 season, there was, you know, billions of dollars handed out, and then about right after Hurricane Sandy, the Congress had gotten onto FEMA about spending and misspending, and that launched the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees FEMA, to do, like, I think, thousands of these investigations. And a lot of them were focused on Florida during the 2004-2005 season, and they found a whole bunch of discrepancies and misspending that they ended up clawing back a lot of that money. Some of it was just unspent money, but there was a lot of money that was unspent. So the state, in reaction, put this intense auditing system, but then they realize the intense auditing system is slowing things down. So at the end of the day, I guess we can all blame Congress.
Which people so like to do, yeah. Yeah.
Blame the institution.
Yeah.
Eric Sarkisian, walking through all of that timeline for us. He's a reporter with Political Florida with us from our sister station, WFSU in Tallahassee. Eric, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, next week, Florida's congressional members are due to get a briefing from the FBI on Russian attempts to hack the 2016 election, CNN reports. The Mueller report revealed that the election system of at least one Florida county was compromised by Russian hackers. It's the first time the U.S. government claimed Russia did gain access to a U.S. voting network. Now, so far, details about this are sparse, and we still don't know which Florida county was compromised.
Yeah, but this week, Melissa, at a congressional subcommittee hearing in Broward County examining voting rights in Florida, Congresswoman Federica Wilson recognized the Russian question.
It's been rumored that county is Broward. No one has proven that yet, but the governor has set up a meeting with the FBI to determine which county it was, how far they got, and what kind of impact that made on the state.
Speaking of voting, Florida lawmakers also passed a bill this session that could make it more difficult for petition-driven questions to show up on your election ballot. Referenda on environmental spending, medical marijuana, restoring voting rights for felons. They all used voter signatures to get on previous ballots. And, of course, the legislature also passed a measure this session requiring people who've had a felony conviction to pay fines or fees before they can regain access to the ballot. Critics call that a modern-day form of a poll tax. So here's the question we're pondering right now. First of all, how secure is your vote out there, Florida, in light of what we learned in the Mueller report? And also, how accessible is voting, and what can we all do to ensure our vote counts? Here now with more, we welcome Ian Sancho. He's the former Leon County Supervisor of Elections. Still with us, Greg Allen of NPR. And your calls and tweets, 305-995-1800 to join us. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Ian Sancho, you're a former supervisor of elections for Leon County. Let's begin with you. Here's what we know. During the 2016 election, we know that Russia military intelligence, the GRU as it's called, did target VR Systems. That's a Florida company that counties use here in Florida to maintain their voter registration databases. The Russian hackers sent out phishing emails from Gmail accounts with VR Systems in its name, and they sent out a malicious file to county elections officials. The Mueller report has confirmed that at least one Florida county was compromised, and the FBI will be briefing our delegation on this. We don't know which county, but what was your reaction when you learned of this? As a former supervisor of elections, you were in charge of election security, ballot counting, and making sure the vote was accurate. What was your reaction?
Well, I was not surprised, frankly. It's been clear to me that the election infrastructure, not only in Florida, but in the country, is not secure. Has not been secure, and security was not a concern when the voting machine standards currently in place for all the 350,000 voting machines used in the United States were designed. Security was not an issue in the early 1980s, and most of the generation of voting equipment used in this country began in the 1980s, the development in the 1990s. It takes a while to get a new system up and running, but again, the systems themselves are not secure.
And we're talking, and when you say that, two vendors provide about 80% of U.S. election equipment, isn't that right? And they have vulnerabilities. They have vulnerabilities. They could be targeted by someone on the inside, perhaps, who wanted to hack the vote, or an outside hacker, say Russian military intelligence. Can you explain those vulnerabilities for people?
Well, there are two types of vulnerabilities. The first type that people tend to think of is, are the voting machines themselves attackable? Can they be hacked? And that, fortunately, most of the voting equipment is not connected to the internet, nor should it ever be connected to the internet. But you connect it to modems, you connect it to disks, you can connect it to USBs. All of those are attack points to infiltrate systems and penetrate them. In terms of the state of Florida, we have paper ballots. We got paper ballots in 2007 when the touchscreen, known as DREs, direct recording electronic devices, in Sarasota County in 2006 lost 18,000 electronic votes. They disappeared. It could have been user error. It could have been voter error. We don't know, but this all goes back to 2000, when after that massive meltdown of poor technology and lack of well-trained election officials, this country decided to do something about it. But when they upgraded the technology, they did not upgrade the standards for security. Not at all. In fact, I went to Washington and spoke and testified before the House Administration Committee in support of Congressman Rush Holt's bill, by the way, who was a physicist in Congress, who demanded that our electronic voting machines have paper auditable trails. He failed in 2003, he failed in 2005, and that law has still not been passed. And even if you have paper ballots, such as Florida does use, we do not statistically audit those ballots to confirm that the numbers are correct. In fact, all we do is refeed them through the same machines, which, if they were compromised, would give us the same wrong number. Florida's audit system is among the worst in the country. And in fact, there was legislation in this legislative session in Florida that would have required that or allowed jurisdictions that had much more sophisticated audit equipment, equipment that could do a 100% recount of every vote independently cast from the voting system within 30 minutes. The Florida legislature refused to pass that legislation. So we have actually technology which could safeguard our paper ballots, which Florida law prevents election officials from using.
Ian,
that's how bad the situation in Florida
is. Let me remind
is.
Folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Talking about voting security, it has come up again in Florida, thanks in no small part to a claim in the Mueller report that one Florida county was compromised by the Russian intelligence agency during the 2016 campaign. Greg Allen, NPR correspondent, is with us in Miami. Greg, the possibility of a hack job prior to Election Day was being covered. It was being discussed. There was a conference of county election supervisors across the state of Florida in Broward County a year ago, or rather 2 years ago, so a good 3 or 4 months before the 2016 campaign. There were millions of dollars of federal money that were handed out to try to shore up security. So how surprised should we be about this Mueller report claim? And frankly, what are questions like Ian and others need to hear answers to in the weeks ahead?
Well, we knew that incursions were happening or were likely to be happening, but what's been surprising is the varied response we've had from our public officials about this issue, and how the information has come out so slowly and sporadically. And this, I'm thinking about during the most recent campaign, and when Senator Bill Nelson mm-hmm. brought it up, maybe wrongly brought it up, but he brought up the fact that what he said at the time turns out to be basically true, that there had been our voting systems had been penetrated. And at that time, his opponent, then Governor Scott, said that he didn't know what he was talking about, and they basically shouted him down, and Nelson never could get confirmation from the FBI or from anyone
and we
at
learned,
the federal level.
We learned this week too. Senator Marco Rubio said publicly this week, didn't he, that mm-hmm. he knew yeah. this was happening, but he did not feel he could speak about it publicly the way former Senator Nelson did.
Right, because it was classified information yeah. he received as a member of the Intelligence Committee, and so. It's unfortunate that we're finding out about it now, especially when the Secretary of State and the governor had never knew about it. Right. It was even worse, and they're still trying to get answers. So we'll see what the congressional delegation gets this week. But it's been it's another misstep by, I think, federal officials in dealing with the state.
Putting it politely at this point, mm-hmm. considering that we're already staring down Election Day 2020, and to Ian Sancho's concern about the vulnerabilities that still remain for Florida voting. Meantime, some changes happening in terms of how Florida voters can get questions on the ballot, questions that have been successful in the past, approving medical marijuana, for instance. That was a voter signature effort. All of that still to come on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we continue talking about the Mueller report's claim that Russia hacked at least one Florida county election system in 2016, examining concerns about the security of your vote and access to the ballot here in Florida. Let's go to Scott. He's in Interlochen. Hey, Scott, you're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hey, the reason I'm calling is regards to the 2018 election, and it seemed like there was some malfeasance possibly going out in Broward County, and I'd like to see some kind of reform to where we have a supervisors of elections being appointed in instead of elected to make it easier for the state to intervene, because law enforcement, independent supervisors should be able to come in and there was funny business going on down there, and we need some kind of regulation or new law passed, because it seemed like Rick Scott didn't want to jump in because Brenda Snipes was elected. And, people weren't allowed in to watch them count votes. I saw the videos, and I'm concerned about that happening again as well.
All right, Scott, thanks for that. Let's talk about that and Ian Sancho, all of the issues around election security in Florida. Now, Scott was talking about the midterm elections and troubles with the vote in Broward County. Brenda Snipes, he referenced her, the former supervisor of elections in Broward. She came under heavy criticism. Some voters perceived malfeasance. Others said there was just incompetence going on there. But whether it comes to that or everything we're talking about vulnerabilities in our election systems, you know, attack points with USB or memory cards, cellular modems, that's another one where you can potentially hack a voting system in Florida. You know, all of this is serving to undermine voter confidence in elections, Ian, isn't it? People don't have confidence that their vote will be counted accurately.
Well, the danger is that if you speak the truth, no one will act on it. And in fact, the individual who's speaking the truth then becomes the person that the government piles on. And I've had this myself. In 2006, we did something that was memorialized in a documentary called Hacking Democracy. We did a red team attack on the optical scan voting system that we used in Leon County, and we demonstrated that an individual could take over the memory card and, in fact, alter the outcome of the election, and the administrator who is running the election would not know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, that vulnerability was, once we exposed it, I was attacked by all three of the vendors that sold equipment here. They did not want that information out. The government, the governor and Secretary of State Glenda Hood began activities to try to remove me from office for exposing the truth. The issue is, if we want to bring credibility to the election system, we need to focus on the problems and the solutions, not attacking the individuals who raised the questions that need to be raised. Our system is insecure. It could be made secure if we went to risk-limiting audits or machine audits that provided for the kind of re-examination independent of the voting software that counted it. The software is the problem. The software can be taken over. The software is buggy. The software has errors already built into it.
And isn't it possible, Ian, let me ask you this as a follow-up. Some cybersecurity experts have said hackers, Russian hackers or others, they could have planted malicious software that still hasn't even been detected. It can lie dormant and be activated at the appropriate time if you're trying to throw an election. Is that a valid concern?
The software can, yes, it is, because the software can be written to erase itself after it has perpetrated its negative act. That is how dangerous the situation is. So, in fact, you must check the paper ballots. That's why Kirstjen Nielsen, our former Homeland Security Director, testified in March before the Senate that if you are voting, you must be voting on a paper ballot. And if you're voting on a paper ballot and you're not doing an audit, you are a national security threat to the United States of America in 2019. And I see very few state legislators, state election directors, or even national figures acting with the kind of purpose to deal with that issue now.
Ian, you're a former county election supervisor in Leon County. If you were still in office, if you were still an election supervisor, and you found out next week or by the end of the month when the FBI, if the FBI ultimately releases which county it was that fell victim to this Russian hack, and you were the election supervisor in that county, what would you do? What's on your priority list?
Well, fortunately, Leon County is one of the five counties that did actually purchase automatic auditing equipment that was started to be marketed by a Clear Ballot company in Massachusetts in 2012, who, by the way, the founder of that company.
Put all that aside, though, for a moment. I know it's a hypothetical. You're the election supervisor in office, and you find out, it becomes public, that your county was the one that was referred to in the Mueller report. What do you do?
Well, first off, I would probably have to apologize and possibly resign. But let me tell you, we may never know who was hacked because the FBI has a policy of not telling the truth relative to the disclosure of the methods and sources of how they find out
sources
information.
Sources and methods. Not only that, the report said at least one Florida county.
At
it could
least.
Be more than one.
I was on the
good point.
I was on the telephone call on September 30th, 2016, when the FBI had a confidential call with the supervisor of elections. And at that point, they told us that a malicious actor had attempted to penetrate a Florida vendor. That's all they would tell. We know now, based upon the Reality Winner information and the Mueller report, that the FBI actually lied to the 67 supervisor of elections and the Secretary of State staff that was on that call. The penetration had already taken place, but the FBI did not want to inform the Russians, and so they didn't inform us. Hmm. And it is not known today whether or not the FBI has actually told the jurisdiction or the jurisdictions that were involved that they were penetrated. No one is coming forth from the association to claim that they were the jurisdiction. And quite frankly, I don't believe the FBI will tell the truth to the governor and to the Secretary of State. They prize secrecy. That's what spies do. And even though that may run counter to the culture of elections, which is counter to secrecy, I don't believe the FBI will disclose who the individual or individuals were that were penetrated.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Here's a tweet from a listener. If it wasn't for a recount, we would have had the wrong agriculture commissioner. I believe the system is broken on the human level by crooked people. Greg Allen of NPR, let's bring you back into the conversation. As I said a moment ago to Ian, there's widespread cynicism and concern about the integrity of the vote in Florida in particular, leading into the next big election in 2020. And listening to Ian's technical and professional expertise on this doesn't serve to shore up our confidence, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I'd like to hear from Ian on this question, is that we've heard from the Secretary of State and the election supervisors, the association, that they believe that the systems are safe now, and that they also believe that the vote was not compromised 2 years ago. And I wonder if we can say, if we can knowing what we know about the FBI and the lack of information coming out, are we confident that the vote was not tampered with here in Florida? What do you think of that, Mr. Sanchez?
I believe that without evidence showing that a valid audit has been accomplished, I don't think we actually even know, for example, today, without even the Russian situation, what was the accurate vote in Hillsborough County? What was the accurate vote in Broward County? Both of those counties, after conducting their machine scan recounts and the 2018 election, ended up with vastly different totals at the end of the day. I know that in both jurisdictions, they took their total closest to the election. They did not use their retabulated totals that they generated from their precinct tabulators, because the numbers after they counted the votes then were so different from the election totals that they got right after the election, they didn't know which one is correct. And that goes to the flaw of, we do not do a reliable, scientifically valid recount to determine the accuracy of those votes on those pieces of papers that we call ballots. That is what we must do. If, in fact, the computer systems can be taken over, in fact, the only solution is to actually retabulate the voters' marks that they have placed on those optical scan ballots. That will catch any software glitch or computer programmable error that has generated those numbers. We do not do that in Florida, and that is the problem. Only four states do a reliable scientific audit in this country.
Ian Sancho, with over 8 million votes cast, is it reasonable to expect an exact replica of count after count after count?
Yes. Yes, the idea, which kind of the myth that developed after the 2000 election, is you could never get an accurate count. That's hogwash. With optical scan paper ballots, you can determine every vote marked on an optical scan paper ballot. It is scientifically provable, except we don't bring scientific principles into this process, and we're comfortable with that because they've never been brought into this process. The vendors control the testing of their equipment. The government doesn't test their equipment. Private vendors do, and if the private vendors decide that there are problems with that, they're not going to get any more return business at these testing centers. So there's this whole system that's built around making sure that the vendors can use the equipment so that they can make their profits. But the system should not be built around private, profitable systems for vendors in the most public arena that we have, which is a public elections. We have built a system.
And we're almost out of time, Ian.
That is absolutely ridiculous.
But I can't thank you enough for all of these amazing insights. What a great amount of information here on the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us. I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Alexander Gonzalez and Heather Schatz are the producers.
We'll be back next week.